All right, so there is a special program on L-functions and automorphic forms, and I will just treat this first lecture as an introduction to that of sorts. And the second and third lecture will involve discussing some of what I mentioned here, going into some details. So let me start with a very, very classical. The title of these lectures is L-functions, so and equidistribution. So most of the applications I will give of this theory will be to problems of equidistribution. Problems which on the face of it look like they might not have to do with L functions. Some of them certainly do if you have any experience with this, but some of them look rather far removed from it. And that's what makes this so interesting, is that the applications are rather varied and some really unexpected. And in fact, not every application in the end uses L functions. There are some new techniques, some really powerful new techniques in ergodic theory that I'll spend the third lecture on, which seem to be very competitive actually, as you'll see. All right, so starting with a very, very classical, we start with Euler, who gives us a formula for the sum of n to the minus s as a product over primes, which is a simple relation obtained. I'm going to stand here rather than move around, so that if you can't see it, you'll never see it. But if you can see it, then you're all set. How's that? So if I'm in your way now, you probably want to move. All right, so that's Euler. So this, of course, comes from expanding 1 over 1 minus p to the minus s in a binomial expansion, then multiplying out, and then using that every integer is a product of primes uniquely. All this, of course, making sense for s bigger than 1. And this already has information about prime numbers, as Euler knew. As far as equidistribution goes, probably the most basic kind of theorem of the type, of a certain kind of theorem, a certain type that I will be discussing, is Dirichlet, still one of my favorite theorems, even though it looks rather simple these days. It is, at the time, was really a major theorem because, like many great theorems, invented many different concepts and introduced a number of new ideas with one goal in mind. I'll tell you what that goal was. So he considers characters of the integers into C, well, actually of a certain ring. These are functions, Dirichlet characters as we call them. They're functions which are multiplicative. Chi of mn is chi of m times chi of n. They normalize to be chi 1 at 1. They are periodic with some period. So this is periodic, some minimal period, called the conductor of chi. So I'll assume always chi is periodic and multiplicative. So it's really coming from a character of Z mod QZ star, the invertible elements modulo Q. So in fact, the values assumed are roots of unity or zero if M is not relatively prime to Q. And then, just like with Euler, if you take this product, because of this property, you have the same product to series relation. We call this an Euler product. And its generalizations, Euler products, because Euler introduced them. And these are, again, Euler products of degree 1. By that, I mean degree 1 in p to the minus s. And this series here is called a Dirichlet L function, LS chi. Notice the s, a lot of experts here, but I don't, there are a lot of notational problems. That when you get old, all you argue about is notation. So let's start there. The arithmetic geometers will always put the object first, L variety, and then S. But Dirichlet, I went and looked into his work, actually. He doesn't use this notation. But the early people use this notation. It's probably best to stick with it. And I will certainly stick with it. So the variable S comes first, the character second. This Dirichlet L function can be analyzed when S gets to 1. And that's what Dirichlet had in mind. And the most important thing about it is that it is never 0 at 1. So if I put some chi n over n, if chi is not the trivial character, this series will converge conditionally, and it's not by any means obvious that it's not equal to 0, that sum or the product. But Dirichlet proved this fact, and this was crucial in his further development, because what he was after is the real basic and most fundamental example of an equidistribution theorem. He proved there are infinitely many primes in arithmetic progression using these L functions. Once you have these L functions, this is really easy, especially if you know that. The precise theorem is that if you look at primes P, which are congruent to A modulo Q, and as long as A and Q are relatively prime, then potentially there are infinitely many primes in this progression, otherwise there aren't. But if you have this condition, then he shows the infinitely many primes congruent to A modulo Q. In fact, he shows an equidistribution fact that to first order, to higher order, it's not true actually, but to first order, if you count the number of primes less than X, he didn't quite study these sums, but that doesn't matter. If you count, then we know this certainly. The sum of primes less than X with primes congruent to A modulo Q, that'll be the sum asymptotically the same as the number of primes less than X which are congruent to B modulo Q for A and B, two different residue classes. So for that reason, I will call that equidistribution. The primes don't prefer to be in one progression rather than another. So that is the typical example of the kind of theorem you get from L functions, and it was the first introduction. This is why L functions were introduced. Riemann took this a step further by looking at these L functions not just as functions of the real variable S, which Dirichlet was mainly worried about, but as a function of the complex variable S. And he discovered, well, to argue, some people say other people discovered, but certainly he was the first to point out its importance. He discovered that these functions as a function of S are entire, at least these L functions. The Riemann zeta function has a simple pole, but if the chi is not the trivial character, then not only do they extend to be analytic functions of S, but they satisfy something that I will call a functional equation, which is extremely important. So the functional equation for Dirichlet L function, say, the character chi at minus 1 will be either plus 1 or minus 1. So for simplicity, let me assume it's plus 1, it's even. Then if you multiply the L function by a gamma function times pi to the minus s, the gamma function is an elementary function. These functions, Ls chi, we don't know that much about. We know a lot, but we don't know the entire story, as many of you know. And that's this problem in the middle here. But gamma we know, so if you put this factor there, the completed function satisfies a relation between S goes to 1 minus S and chi goes to chi bar, and there's a number of modulus 1 which intervenes in this relation when going from S to 1 minus S. Tau of chi is a Gauss sum, its size is square root Q, so it's some number of modulus 1. And this is the famous functional equation of the Dirichlet L functions, and I should emphasize that it is proved by Riemann. Well, he didn't discuss these, but his method works identically for this. It's proved by Riemann using Poisson sum, as I point out there. So the key ingredient in that is the Poisson summation formula. I emphasize that because when we get to more general L functions, we will not have Poisson sum, and we're going to have to find the substitute, and that's what the subject's about, trying to find the substitute. All right, the central problem about these functions. So Dirichlet already worried about where these functions are zero and not vanishing at one was central to his argument. If you want to understand the deeper aspects of the subject, you need to know where all the zeros are, at least, or are not, is a better way of saying it. And the central unsolved problem here, for which you can apparently get $1 million if you do it just in the case if chi is 1. Though I would be very disappointed if you could only do it in that case. It has no applications at all. It's only in the context of more general L functions that this is extremely powerful, like the Dirichlet L functions, and which gives you understanding on progressions in a very complete way. The famous Riemann hypothesis asserts that all the zeros of the completed L function are on the line of Hopf. Now, since I try to be up to date here, the theory of L functions is used heavily all the time in the theory of primes, and it's used heavily in a very interesting, lovely recent paper of Dan Goldston and Yildirim, which you will find is in all the papers, actually. It's been covered amazingly. I was quite surprised by this. So their theorem is the following. They use some elementary truncations and some nice positivity arguments, and then the workhorse is always still the theorems that come from analysis of L functions, which give you primes in progressions, the right number, at least to first order. But the arguments that are new in this are really novel and elementary. And their theorem is the following, just to update you, if you're reading the newspaper. Let's look at the nth prime. Pn is the nth prime. And let's look at, the Pn plus first prime minus the Pnth primes. And look at the difference between consecutive primes. The prime number theorem says that that this, on average, will be 1 if I divide by log Pn. So if I sum n up to x, the prime number theorem will tell me, essentially, that this average is 1. Numerical experiments, if you do experiments on this, show that if you look at, say, the n plus first prime minus the nth prime and normalize this way so that the average value of these numbers is now 1, and you look at how those numbers are distributed, they seem to be distributed like random numbers, or what are called Poisson distributed, meaning that the limit distribution of those numbers would have density e to the minus x dx. In particular, you certainly find that Pn plus 1 minus Pn over log Pn should be arbitrarily small infinitely often. In fact, if there are infinitely many twin primes, you should be able to show that this is 2 over log Pn infinitely often, but that's a much, much harder problem. And what is done here, which is remarkable, because before all that was known was that you could make Pn plus 1 minus Pn over log Pn infinitely often less than some number less than 1. And that number had a sequence of improvements over the years. But it's quite a breakthrough when somebody is able to actually... I mean, this is still a very modest result, but it was something that was stuck for many years. And the analytic theory of L functions is certainly one of the ingredients, and this is certainly the beginnings of the equidistribution theorem, that the consecutive spacing between primes, when properly normalized, should behave like random numbers. Okay, so that's very classical. Now I come to classical. Let's look at a fancier L function. They'll get fancier and fancier as the lecture goes on. And it is for the fancier L functions that the equidistribution problems become really maybe much more interesting and much more difficult. So what I want to introduce here is something from algebraic number theory, which is take an irreducible polynomial of degree d over the rationals, fix that. Maybe it's a quadratic polynomial, x squared plus 1, but any fixed such polynomial. For quadratic, the question I'm about to describe here is well understood. And then look at this polynomial. It's got rational coefficients, say integer coefficients, and let P be a large prime, and look at that polynomial modulo P. So it's now a polynomial over the field with P elements. And the question you might be interested in, and we are interested in, is how does that polynomial factor as I vary P? So as I change a prime, how does this, does it factor into linear factors? Does it factor into something in between? All right, that's another equidistribution problem, which is more subtle than the first one. The first, discussion contains the first one, by the way. But the first equidistribution was about primes in residue classes, and this will be about primes in its finest form, about how some non-commutative element in a group associated with a prime moves as you vary the prime. So let's let K be the splitting field of this irreducible polynomial. It's a finite extension of Q. Let G be the Galois group of this field. It's a finite group. So this is all going to be connected with finite group theory. And to understand how these split, one needs to know a little bit of algebraic number theory, so I'll just do it descriptively. This part is elementary. Let me take a representation of this finite group into GLN. So this is just a homomorphism of this group, and I want it to be irreducible, into n by n complex matrices. The way you study a finite group, or the right way to understand certain aspects of a finite group, is to understand its irreducible representation. So let's take one of these, probably not the trivial representation to make it interesting, into GLN. And for each prime P, depending on how the prime splits there in a way that can be described easily using finite field theory and a little bit of algebraic number theory, there is a conjugacy class in the Galois group, which we call Frobenius at P, associated to each prime P. I don't want to go into the exact definition of it because that would take up too much of my time. So I have here, I'm going to leave here three survey lectures, one of which has a whole appendix explaining the precise definition of this. One of them is the Blythe lectures I gave here exactly 10 years ago, of which I will describe the solution of three or four problems that were raised then. 10 years later, they are finally solved. And the third one is just a survey on L functions with a paper I wrote with Ivanich. So those papers, I think, will be ample to satisfy anybody who's has never seen this and wants to actually see where these are, what they are and how they define. But right now, all I want you to feel is with each prime P, instead of having a conjugacy class, instead of having a residue class modulo Q, you have a conjugacy class in this Galois group called the Frobenius conjugacy class. And if you want to measure how these move as you vary the primes, you form, in the same fashion that Dirichlet formed an L function, you form, following Artin, this is a famous construction of Artin, ML Artin, an L function of this representation. Such a thing is called a Galois representation, and we form this LS row, which is a product over all primes. There's a definition which is a little trickier when the prime divides the discriminant of the number field, but for P not dividing the discriminant of the number field, this expression makes sense. The identity, this is an N by N matrix, if it's in GLN. Row of Frobenius is an N by N matrix, and this does not depend on the choice of conjugacy, this determinant, as you can easily check. So this is a local factor for each prime. In the case of the Dirichlet L function, the local factor was 1 minus chi P, P to the minus S. It was degree 1 in P to the minus S. Here, this Euler product will be degree n in p to the minus s. And the famous Artin L function is that. It was a great achievement of Brouwer, the finite group theorist and algebraist, Richard Brouwer, who proved, I think Artin ordered this theorem about induction from monomials, combining what is called class field theory with some finite group theory. Brouwer and I would say Artin together proved that LS rho actually extends to a meromorphic function in S. So, unlike the knowledge we have for the Riemann zeta function, or the Dirichlet L function, where Poisson sum was responsible for the understanding of the function, here we don't have that kind of deep understanding, but we still know quite a bit. This function is meromorphic, and it satisfies an exact functional equation. These are consequences of the works, a class field theory, a theory which was developed by Artin concerning one-dimensional Galois representations. And this is now an n-dimensional Galois representation. And Artin made a famous conjecture that these functions, actually, if rho is irreducible and not a trivial representation, are always entire. So we know they're meromorphic with potentially many, many poles, but the conjecture is there aren't any poles. The meromorphicity and the analysis allows you to understand these functions in the real part of S greater or equal to 1, which is always enough to get the crudest part of an equidistribution theorem. And actually, Chabotarev proved this equidistribution theorem without the complete machinery of these Artin L functions. There's a very beautiful paper by Lenstra on the history of the Chabotarev theorem. But let me just tell you what the Chabotarev theorem says, and it's an easy consequence of this theory, even without knowing this famous Artin conjecture, and that is that just like all L function equidistribution theorems, as you vary over the primes up to X, you look at how these conjugacy classes move in the Galois group. So for each prime P, we have a different conjugacy class, and the theorem is they become equidistributed in the conjugacy classes. So the number of P's less than X for which the conjugacy, for which Frobenius P lies in a given conjugacy class, is the obvious measure of the size of the conjugacy class divided by the size of the group. So, and this is called the Chabotarev density theorem, which is extremely useful in applications of algebraic number theory to many, many problems. I think one Murty and another Murty must have written one paper called An Application of Chabotarev to Something. Several. Okay. With that title. Several Murtys, several papers with the same title. All right. Now, one of the great achievements of Langlands, actually, a Canadian mathematician, as you all know, was that he proved that if you have a two-dimensional Galois representation, so that's when it's just into two dimensions, and it's solvable, so the image of a finite group in 2 by 2 complex matrices is is very restricted. Klein classified all finite subgroups of SL2C. They're all solvable except for one, which is the icosahedral group, which is the case we know very little about, in fact, nothing about, especially if it's even, essentially nothing. But in all other cases, we do know that Artin conjecture. And this was this is the famous Langlands tunnel theorem. It's very useful in used by others, as you know. And that theorem proceeds, and this is the direction I'm moving in. You know, we don't have Poisson sum to show something's entire. We just don't know how to proceed. But we have another set of ideas, which is where I'm heading. It's a theory of automorphic forms, which provides L functions an entirety, which is what we're looking for, of L functions by another means. And certainly Langlands' proof of this fact that Langlands' tunnel did one of the cases, this Langlands' tunnel theorem is highly dependent on understanding the theory I'm about to put forth in a moment, the whole spectral theory of automorphic forms, the full use of the trace formula, etc., etc. But at very basic level, Langlands and Tunnel established this Artin conjecture for all but the icosahedral case when the image is two-dimensional. This is a remarkable theorem. But I want to concentrate on the case that's completely not understood, because there's a very nice insight that was made by Booker that I want to explain to you. So suppose rho is even. So rho is a two-dimensional Galois representation. Now rho, so it's a representation of the Galois group of Q bar over Q. Finite image always. Rho will do something to complex conjugation. Doesn't matter which particular complex conjugation you choose. We say it's even if the rho of complex conjugation is plus one rather than minus one. And if that's the case, then if you form the L function that I wrote down, the product of a primes of det, y minus Frobenius, and so on, and you write it as a series, so you just collect terms, and this will be some lambda rho n to the minus s. Of course, included here are the bad primes, but I certainly don't worry about that here. Then comes this remarkable step that I'm going to forget about these things. I'm going to make an eigenfunction of a partial differential operator, in this case, genuinely an eigenfunction. No holomorphic. This is genuinely an eigenfunction, something that's poison to many. But if you want to understand this problem, you better eat this poison. That's the bottom line. You'll see you have to eat this poison. It's not poison. It's just beautiful. And I don't know anybody who's got really bad health problems from eating them yet. So form this. So replace n to minus s by y to the half, a function of y, which is a Bessel function, and cosine 2 pi n x. So this is a function of z, where z is x plus I, y, and z is in the upper half plane. Just let me remind you very briefly, I put in this extra slide a moment ago, that the 2 by 2 matrices, SL2R, so this is where automorphic forms come, and I want to convince you they are in. You cannot tackle this problem without automorphic forms in view of what I'm about to say. That's not true. But because one should never limit what people can do. But whatever you do, you'll be saying something about automorphic forms if you are able to tackle it in any other way. So if you take 2 by 2 matrices of determinant 1, SL2R, that acts in the usual way in the upper half plane by projective linear transformations or linear fractional, GZ is AZ plus B over CZ plus D. For later, let me note that the upper half plane H, which is those Zs with imaginary part positive, can be identified if I make the G act on the upper half plane. These preserve the upper half plane. The stabilizer of the point square root minus 1 is the 2 by 2 matrices which are in the orthogonal group, SO2. So this quotient space is the upper half plane. And this weird expansion is really just reflecting the fact that this thing is an eigenfunction of the operator, which looks like the ordinary Laplacian, but this is Laplacian for the hyperbolic metric on the upper half plane. So the upper half plane comes with a hyperbolic, Lobachevsky, Bolai, whatever you call that object, this non-Euclidean space. It comes with a line element, it comes with a volume element, and it also comes with the divergence of gradient, the Laplace-Beltrami operator. So this Laplacian is what is, that's where the answer to this question of two-dimensional Galois representation lies, in the following sense. That function Psi, whose Fourier series I wrote down, should A, be an eigenfunction with eigenvalue, a specific number, 1/4 for this operator. So it's an eigenfunction of Laplacian. It's not a holomorphic function. There's no obvious, in fact, we don't know. This is one of our difficulties. We have no arithmetic geometric meaning to this at all. Nobody's ever been able to find this. It's probably there isn't one. At least, anyway, we don't know one. And so one, it's an eigenfunction of that operator, and B, it's got an invariance property. This is what makes it a modular form, and that is that it's periodic with respect to a certain subgroup of 2x2 matrices. So if you look at the 2x2 matrices with determinant 1, A, B, C, D, all integers in determinant 1, that's called the modular group, and I hope most of you are familiar with that. It's not going to be invariant for all gamma in the modular group. It'll be invariant under some subgroup. I've taken a slightly bigger one than most people take. I call it gamma n here. This is the 2x2 matrices which are congruent to the identity modulo n. It's a finite index subgroup of SL2Z. This quotient H mod gamma n is then a Riemann surface and also a hyperbolic surface of genus about n cubed. So it's a bigger space as n gets big. And n here is the Artin conductor. It's an integer associated with a Skolnick representation. So this is a conjecture. Well, it's not what Booker showed. This is a remarkable theorem. That if the Artin conjecture is true for LS rho, so suppose LS rho is entire. We knew it was meromorphic. Suppose it's entire. Then this C will be a modular form. It's well known that if C is a modular form, this is entire. So he's showing the opposite direction. This is a genre of a theorem called the converse theorem, and I think Jim Cogdell is giving a whole course on converse theorems. But what's really shocking about this thing is the first occurrence of any converse theorem in the literature is really Hecker, and Hecker was looking for a converse theorem he had converse theorems of the type, something's analytic if and only if something's modular, but that was always only at the level of SL2Z. He couldn't generalize this to gamma n. And it's a very famous paper of André Weil, 1967, where he showed how to generalize this to gamma n. And he pointed out that if you want to have such a converse theorem, you have to twist. So you have to take these Dirichlet characters that I introduced at the beginning and know the analytic properties, not just for LS rho, but LS rho times chi for a certain bunch of chi's associated with n. So Weil pointed out, this is your missing data. This was a turning point in the history of mathematics, because for those of you who don't know, before then had always poo-pooed this conjecture whose name, what do we call it? The Shimura Taniyama conjecture, let's call it. That conjecture, which was certainly brought forth by Shimura and Taniyama in the late 50s and early 60s, verbally at least, they said this is, of course, nonsense. And so these guys didn't put it in print because they was very clear in saying that this conjecture is just wishful thinking. But after they found that the conjecture, which not for Galois representations, they was thinking of elliptic curves, doesn't matter. Once he found that these analytic properties are essentially, if you allow twists, are essentially equivalent to being modular, then of course he had to change his tune, and he makes the conjecture, and then for a number of years it was known as the Weil conjecture until later the naming became a little more complicated. And this happens to be a very important and fundamental conjecture, and a very unexpected one. But if you believe the Artin conjecture, what Booker's telling you, you don't have to twist. That's the remarkable new discovery of Booker, that you don't have to twist. So I reckon Weil must be turning in his grave.
So what's the punchline?
It's a theorem. What? How does he prove it?
The new idea
is, okay, I'll give you the proof. This is his thesis, 2003. One of the insights that's really used here is he's not proving a converse theorem, say, for elliptic curves without twists. He's using the fact that Brouwer has proved the exact functional equation and that it's meromorphic. So nobody's ever used in a converse theorem that it's meromorphic before. So what happens is you entertain the possibility of poles, and then you show the poles are inconsistent with themselves. I didn't believe it for 2 weeks, by the way. I kept on saying you made a calculational error. And when I went and checked it, I had to apologize. it's a remarkable, it's based on a calculation. I would say we don't really understand it, but I can show you the calculation. But it's philosophically quite striking. And at that point, for those of you who don't have never thought about this before, what this theorem says, which is remarkable, is that if you want to understand these L functions of Artin, you may find some clever way of understanding, some other way of understanding it that nobody has any attack on, but this says that it's completely equivalent, even without twists, to being modular. So the minute you've proved that the function's entire, you've constructed a modular form, and you haven't used Poisson sum. Poisson sum, needless to say, the Artin conjecture for the icosahedral remains as unsolved as it was before. This is just philosophically shocking. I brought Booker's thesis, which has many other fantastic results in it, so I'll leave it here. Is there some library here? No? You have a library, excellent, where people can look at these things. All right, now, the bottom line of all this is that if you want to understand these deeper equidistribution problems, even I started with very classical, then I got to classical, which was Artin, and now I'm going to actually turn to modern. I hope you will maybe agree with me that I'm making the case that you have to look at a much more general object, and there is a set of objects that we have, which we think is all-inclusive. It's a set of objects which give rise to L functions of any degree that you wish, and for which these L functions are known to be analytic and have a functional equation. In other words, whatever Riemann did for the zeta function, we know how to do for these objects. And I want to tell you what those objects are, because those are the objects of the modern theory and the objects which hopefully will provide all the answers, but that we're very far from solving these general problems, but you'll see they're already enough to solve many problems. So I had the upper half plane. It kind of came out of the blue when I said this thing is an eigenfunction and that it was equivalent. And it turns out that there's no reason to restrict to the real place. We're working with irrational numbers or maybe even a number field in a moment. But if we're working with these objects, there's no reason to... The reals aren't more important than the two-adic numbers, the three-adic numbers, or the p-adic numbers for that matter. So I'm doing something that I never do in a lecture, and this was probably... I've seen other people bomb immediately with this. They often start with this, and then everybody's sleeping immediately. So I brought it in on page 8, and it'll be gone quickly by page 10. So you can sleep for one page. But I've seen Jim Arthur trying to give a lecture. Of course, he has to introduce Adels, and he worked very hard, 45 minutes defining these. And he kept everybody on their feet, on their seats. But they all... Well, I think they got the definition. So I will do it here in 1 minute. So instead of just looking at the real place, which was a 2x2 real matrices, we want to look at something a little fancier. So we look at the real numbers cross the two-adic numbers cross the three-adic numbers and so on for each prime p. This is a certain restricted product with a certain restricted topology, so there's some technical point there. And this is now a very big infinite space, product space. And we look at 2x2 matrices whose entries are these objects. So GL2 of the Adels. And the interesting thing is if you look at the 2x2 matrices with rational entries, before we were looking at 2x2 matrices when I said SL2Z with integer entries, there was a discrete subgroup of SL2R. The theory of automorphic forms is a theory of periodic functions in some setting. Functions which are invariant under some discrete group. Here's the discrete group now. It's even more fancy than it was before. It's a 2x2 matrices with rational entries. That's quite big, but it sits nicely, diagonally, in GL2 of this Adel space there. By putting each rational number will give me an Adel by just having the rational numbers real, the rational numbers a two-adic number, the same number, the diagonal embedding. And to make a Hilbert space, this is analysis. At this point, analysis will enter for the first time in a serious way. To make it into a Hilbert space, why a Hilbert space? That's because the main tool we have here, this all really is due to Selberg. He was the first to realize the importance of introducing a Hilbert space in this context. Is by introducing a Hilbert space, one can do a certain analysis like take a trace of certain operators. So the bottom line, however, is we look at all functions which are, this chi here is to make this L2 space make sense. So for anything in the center which is diagonal matrices, I'll assume that the function transforms by just a fixed character, and a character chi is our old Dirichlet character, or can be thought of as a character of what are called the ideals over the principal ideals. So maybe slough over that technical point. And on the left, like with our eigenfunction before, f of gamma g is f of g. So the functions live on this quotient. I forget about differential operators, but what is equivalent to that, I do some representation theory. I look at the decomposition of the action of what's called the right regular representation. So if I have a function f of g in this space, and I translate that function on the right by an ideal g1, I'll get again a function which is left invariant, or transforms the same way. And this is a unitary action of this GL2 of this ideal group. And if you have a representation of a group, you decompose it into irreducibles. And the theory of automorphic forms is precisely the theory of those irreducible representations. And that is about as complicated a spectral problem as anybody could write down. But you have right here in Toronto one man who's trying to write down exactly what comes up in this decomposition. That's Arthur's dream, is to write down for any semi-simple group what comes up in this decomposition. And he has some very striking conjectures. Let's stick to this 2x2 case. So then an automorphic form is simply an irreducible representation of that group which appears in this right regular representation. And a representation of a product is a tensor product of representations. So the minute I have an irreducible representation of this ideal group, and it's better be automorphic, otherwise I can't do anything with it, so it's going to appear in this space, then it spits out for me, so to speak, a representation of the GL2R, of GL2Q2, GL2Q3. So I get at each prime P an irreducible representation of the local group GL2 of the local field, QP or R, or if in a number field, you would have other places. And that is a fantastic possibility there, right there, to form an L function. In other words, now you see, unfortunately, the subject's a little demanding because you have to sit back and say, can I write down all the irreducible representations of a local group? Analysis is easy. It has to be viewed as trivial. It's very hard, but we have to view it as trivial because we have to assume we can handle all GL2R, what its representations are. That doesn't mean that it's easy to write down all the representations of SL2R, all irreducible unitary representations. Everything will be unitary. Yeah. That's done. It was done by a physicist, by the way. Bogman was the first to write down the representations of SL2R, unitary representation. The understanding of that for a general group is hopelessly difficult, even the local problem. But nevertheless, one does have parameters due to Satake, and more generally, all this will be for GLN, so this is all reasonably well understood, but certainly there's something called Langlands parameters. So each of these local representations can be identified, or is, with each such is identified a set of numbers which characterize that representation, and they allow me at each prime P to make a local L function, LS pi P, which, if this is GL2, will be a function in p to the minus s of degree 2. If this is GLN, if I'm working, I mean, there's nothing to stop us going to n by n matrices, which I think I just did. Did I? I should, more generally, yeah. We should work with GLN. Then I just want to point out that if you're on GLN, then you will get an L function which is degree n, or well, a product of degree n, meaning it's of degree n in p to the minus s. So if I have a Galois representation, an n-dimensional Galois representation, I have at least some dream that maybe I can find a pi here whose local factors are what the Frobenius is. And that's of course, that is how one hopes to prove this. That's how Langlands established those special cases. And the reason I'm showing you this theory is we know at least what Riemann knew for the zeta function, we know for these L functions. So that is, if you take the LS pi, and let me emphasize here, that's another thing that the Langlands crew do, I think, very incorrectly. They define LS to be this thing. But in view of what's coming, that would be a disaster for me. So LS, the Riemann zeta function, is a product of a primes. Nobody put the gamma function there, and I will refuse to put the gamma function there. So the L function is always a product of the finite places, and it's, I'm doing this for a reason. And then you put in, corresponding to the Archimedean pi infinity, a product of gamma functions, which is, there's a recipe of what that is, and you get a completed L function, which I'll call capital lambda rather than L. And the remarkable thing is what replaces Poisson's sum in Riemann's work is the modularity. Remember, pi here will be an automorphic cuspidal representation. That's some technical thing. So pi is an automorphic representation. What's replacing that Poisson sum in analyzing L function is known in this context. It's work of Godemar and Jacquet. One can show this L function is entire and satisfies a functional equation S into 1 minus S, where pi goes to some relative of pi, like chi went to chi bar, pi goes to pi tilde, which is the contragradient representation, which is the representation which is pi a G inverse transpose on GLN. So quite remarkably, we have here a whole slew of L functions for which we know they're entire, and we know, and we have conjectures that they should satisfy Riemann hypotheses, et cetera, et cetera. But one of our difficulties and one of the main thrusts of the theory of automorphic forms is to start off with something like a Galois representation and produce such a pi. Or start off with an elliptic curve and produce such a pi. That was Wiles's great achievement for elliptic curves over Q. There are preciously few techniques to do that, I'm afraid. All right, and that's one thrust, and that's a major thrust of the subject of automorphic forms, is construction of pi's coming out of Galois representation, arithmetic geometry, or Hasse-Weier L functions, or anything of that nature. That is not the theme of the special year, so I will now move in the direction. So we have of equidistribution, but I need the setup. So I will be working freely with these L functions. So these L functions come from decomposing this right regular representation. They're supposed to be sufficient to capture all the L functions of interest in number theory, but that's just a dream. And that's the second half of Booker's thesis. He's the first guy to test numerically that the L function of, say, a genus 2 curve has the right analytic properties, high symmetric powers. He's got a very robust numerical test, which is intimately connected to that theorem for modularity. Nobody has tables of modular forms on GSP4 with large conductor. He's testing these things indirectly, so it's quite nice. All right, now, having set that up, the modern theory is about what comes up. There are three basic conjectures on the analytic side, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on, about these representations pi, which appear in GLN. So my setting is I have GLNAQ, GLNAQ, yes, and I divide by GLNQ or GLNAK if K is a number field, and I divide by GLNK, and I look at all the automorphic representations which come up. That's trying to write down the spectrum of this very complicated eigenvalue problem. The eigenvalues of Laplacian that I was talking about before are a special case of this. There's a very beautiful conjecture, which we now call the Ramanujan conjectures, which tell you which guys are allowed to come up here. Not anybody can come up. That is, it's a local conjecture. If pi is a global automorphic representation coming up, as I described before, there's a conjecture as to what pi p can be or what pi infinity can be. And the conjecture is very precise. It says that if pi has some technical thing called a cuspidal automorphic representation, then these local representations must be have certain decay rates, something called tempered. I will do it in an example here, rather, because I didn't describe for you the representation theory of GLNQP. I can't be specific here. But I want to tell you the nature of this conjecture. The nature of the Ramanujan conjecture is it says that for an automorphic cusp form, pi p's are very restricted. And this is extremely powerful. Let me give you one example of this. So if you're working just with GL2, the upper half plane, and the groups gamma n that I had before, that's these congruent subgroups, then this Ramanujan conjecture, it was Satake who first realized this connection in this language, This Ramanujan conjecture asserts that the first eigenvalue of the Laplacian on this quotient is bigger than or equal to a quarter. That's this Ramanujan conjecture, but in this specific example, this was a conjecture of Selberg around the same time, actually. Satake made this in 66, Selberg in 65. These were two different communities, so to speak. They're the same conjecture, and it's a fundamental conjecture. It's all part of this general Ramanujan conjecture. Here, lambda 1 is the smallest eigenvalue of the Laplacian on this surface, which has genus, hyperbolic surface, which has genus roughly n cubed. So it's getting very big, and yet the first eigenvalue is not going to zero. It's quite counterintuitive. There's no doubt it's true, even these conjectures. And this kind of information, Selberg didn't make it just in a vacuum. He made it because it is extremely powerful in applications of the type that you will see in the last 5 minutes. Yeah, better hurry up here. The second big fat conjecture is that all these L functions are supposed to satisfy the Riemann hypothesis. Let me emphasize, there isn't one L function of this type for which the Riemann hypothesis is known. But I want to emphasize that this should be viewed as a working hypothesis. So while we have no ideas how to do it, it implies things which are of the type that you're going to see in a minute. Particularly, it implies something which looks very technical, which will be the topic of my second lecture, and that's the grand Lindelöf hypothesis. I call this grand because this is not just for Dirichlet L functions, but for all automorphic cusps. The grand Lindelöf hypothesis is a very technical looking thing. This is why I made L the finite part. It's a statement that the L function on the critical line should be bounded by any parameter to the epsilon. So there is for any pi a measure of the size of this automorphic cusp form, which Ivanich and I introduced. We call it the analytic conductor, which tells you pretty much what you want to know about how big pi is, and it's comprised of the places in particular where pi is ramified. So it's got an ordinary type conductor in its definition. And then this Lindelöf hypothesis, which you should believe because it's a trivial consequence of the Riemann hypothesis, is the assertion that this L function is bounded by this conductor to the epsilon. This is very technical looking. This also, the Riemann hypothesis is also a technical looking thing. The interesting part is their power, and you'll see it in a moment. So, the important thing is we have very, very good approximations to these. While we can't solve any of these problems, we have approximations to them. So as far as the first conjecture, which was the Ramanujan conjectures, there are now bounds which are sufficient for many applications, and that will be coming in a second. So they're local bounds, which come merely out of the representation of GLNQP and GLNR and something called generic representations that are due to Jacquet and Schleicher, which are quite old. They often are not good enough, but they are now bounds which use L functions and the kind of tools from L functions due to Lua Rudnick and myself, which are better than these local bounds and which are often just what you need to obtain equidistribution or I want to emphasize they're not bounds which are used typically, well, here's an estimate, now get a better estimate. They're bounds which, here's an estimate which now resolves the problem. This improvement resolves the problem entirely. And for GL2, just for 2, not GLN, there are, and this I think is the topic of one of the special lecture courses, there are some remarkable bounds due to Kim and Shahidi, which use exceptional groups and use various accidental isomorphisms and use a very important technique called the Langland-Shahidi method, and converse theorem. So everything goes into this theorem here of Kim and myself, which is that this is the best known towards Selberg's conjecture. That number's getting reasonably close to one quarter. But it's not that close, because we have milked this up to the exceptional group E8, and now we've run out of ideas. So it's way better than what people were dreaming of many years ago, but somehow this might stand there for a while, or somebody might really just solve the problem completely. The kind of results towards the Riemann hypothesis, I just want to mention one kind of result, and that's called, nobody knows how to prove the Riemann hypothesis, unlike what you might read in the newspapers, but at least as far as I know. So There are theorems which are, again, extremely useful, and that's what I'm emphasizing in these lectures, which say that you statistically cannot have the Riemann hypothesis badly violated for many L functions in a family. So if you count the number of violations of the Riemann hypothesis, mean zeros off the line a half in a family, you'll find that, and slightly to the right of a half, you'll find that the percentage of L functions which are bad is very small. Such theorems, the best example of that is the famous Bombieri-Vinogrado theorem, which offered concerned with ordinary Dirichlet L functions like the very first ones I introduced. This was generalized to a number field. I think it's both of you, right? And it's extremely useful. I've made many uses of it. So these are theorems which tell you the Riemann hypothesis is true most of the time on average, but it does not prove that any one of them satisfies it. Let me emphasize, there's not one L function. It's telling you, it's more about not whether it's true, but how bounding the number that are off the line, number of zeros, bigger than sigma naught, which is bigger than a half. Extremely useful, nevertheless. And my second lecture will be about this other kind of result, which is bounds towards the Lindelöf hypothesis. So there's a trivial bound for an L function, which I'll describe next lecture, and that I call the convexity bound, and everybody calls it that, I think, and a bound which is better than that we'll call subconvexity, and there's a slew of work starting with Hermann Weyl in the case of the Riemann zeta function and Burgess for Dirichlet L functions, and then over Q, Napoff plane starting with Good, but there I would emphasize the series of papers by Duke Friedland and Ivanich as being really important, where they solve all the subconvexity in all parameters. Over a number field, this turns out to be quite a bit more difficult, and Cogdell and Pietetsky Shapiro and myself recently were able to do one aspect of it. And for Euler products of degree 4, there are some works here by myself, Kowalski, Michel Vanderkamp. The point is, we don't know this in general, but this is something I think we will get in general, and this has to equidistribution stunning applications. So now I'll turn to the applications in the last 5 minutes. These two of these will be explained in the next two lectures. The others are just for show. Let me give you one which uses the Selberg eigenvalue bound as a key ingredient at a certain the bound of that lambda 1 being not small at a crucial point, together with other ideas, because it's not so well known, so I thought I would popularize it here. It should be known, but it's not so well known. If you take an irreducible polynomial, like I did at the beginning, and I asked how it factored into linear factors, that was the standard Galois theory problem that Artin formulated, well, that Artin showed us how to attack if we knew the entirety of the L function, for example, or Chabot-Tarek tells us something about it. You could ask, actually, if you actually take the roots, so suppose F has roots over the field with P elements, so the roots are some numbers between 0 and P minus 1, list them, of course that'll be less than a degree, list the roots, say it factors into linear factors, list the roots, and you could ask where do the roots lie? I mean, somehow this was not looked at enough, but it's a very natural question. Where do the roots lie? Well, they'll lie somewhere between 0 and P, well let's divide by P, so now they're numbers between 0 and 1. And you could ask whether, as I vary p, whether the roots, they don't prefer to be in the second half or the first half or the third, they should be equidistributed. Numerical experiments by, I forget who it was, I gave a course in Princeton and somebody did numerical experiments, but I've never seen more numerical experiments, seem to show that for any f, these things are equidistributed. Remarkably, you can prove this for quadratic polynomials, for which the splitting into primes, linear or not, is well known, even by Dirichlet, but where the roots lie, that's what was solved in this problem, in this nice paper. That is a typical application of the spectral theory of the upper half plane, together with, at a crucial moment, knowing about there being no small eigenvalues. They enter dramatically into this kind of calculation. So Duke Friedland Ivanich did one case in Arpad Toth, completed the story. Another problem, which is a resolution of Hilbert's 11th problem, but I'll just state it in a simple application. Which numbers are sums of three squares in a number field? This is a very basic problem, for which equidistribution and L functions are the tool, well, the tool that succeeds. So maybe you don't know that if any number is a sum of three integer squares, this is a famous theorem of Legendre, if and only if it's positive, of course, and is not of the form 4 to the a into 8b plus 7. So there's a local obstruction at the prime 2 which prevents a number to be a sum of three squares, but once you pass that obstruction, then fantastically you are a sum of three squares. This question has been studied since Hilbert's 11th problem of what's the story over a number field. Which numbers are sum of three squares? Four squares was resolved. Five squares was resolved by Ziegel over a number field. Four by Knaeser. Three is very difficult. And the subconvexity theorem of Kogdal, Piatecki, Shapiro, and myself in the number field case allows for the resolution of that problem. The basic answer is that once there are finitely many exceptions, M, say it's a definite quadratic form, say the number field is totally real, then there'll be a finite number of exceptions. There always are, except in one case, a finite number of exceptions, but you can determine them. And then there are a finite number of exceptional square classes that is analyzed completely by Schulz or Pillow, and then you keep out of this finite set for all the bulk of the rest, where the problem is this problem related to equidistribution and L functions. We solve it by making a small amount of progress on estimating an L function on the line of half. So that's problem C in action. Notice this completely resolves the Hilbert 11 problem. So it is, I call these problems pregnant, where you need an epsilon improvement in a bound to completely deliver the theorem, not just another estimate. All right, now, with some of the most interesting progress here about equidistribution, and I'm going to take another 3 minutes if that's okay, concern the problems I raised here 10 years ago in the Blythe lectures. And they were problems of equidistribution from mathematical physics. They are problems about equidistribution not of numbers somewhere or of prime somewhere, but they are actually problems of equidistribution of the automorphic forms themselves. In the third lecture, I will review for you why this is of interest in the theory of quantization of chaotic systems. Here, I just want to say, let's start off with the kind of eigenfunction I wrote down. Take the upper half plane, take SL2z, take the quotient, and let's look at the eigenfunctions. Not eigenvalue a quarter now, but I want to let lambda be large. So an eigenfunction with large eigenvalue. Here's what they look like, by the way. That's the first eigenfunction. There's the modular domain. There's the function drawn in three dimensions. I increase the eigenvalue. This thing starts to oscillate. I've normalized the L2 norm to be 1. I shouldn't say I have. These are graphs of Smotrov and two Russians from Siberia. Yeah, Gorosansky, I have the exact reference in my paper. This is out of the paper. And as you increase the eigenvalue, these things oscillate further. And what the mathematical physicists are very interested in this problem where the classical mechanics is chaotic, is how do these eigenfunctions behave? If I make a probability measure, if I look at these quantum observables, and I'll explain all this in the third lecture, but I know most of you won't be here, so I'm doing it now. I have experience. So that's why I go 3 minutes out. So I want to measure something called quantum observables or some really interesting equidistribution problem here. Take a smooth function on x. X is the upper half plane divided by SL to Z, which is that fundamental domain there. And consider what I will explain as the quantum observable, which in this case is just the integral of A against phi of z squared dv. Now, phi squared, phi is an eigenfunction of L2 norm 1. So this, if I think of this phi of squared dv, I can think of it as a probability measure applied to the function A. These are quantum observables. And one of the really interesting questions that has been raised in the physics literature is, what is the distribution of the quantum observables in such a system when lambda goes to infinity, what's called the semi-classical limit? How is it related to the classical mechanics or the classical observations of A along a, say, typical orbit of this Hamiltonian flow? It's a very difficult problem to understand that, and recently Luo and I have been able to determine the answer in the upper half plane to this. It's completely unexpected. It's not what was predicted. It's much more interesting, and I will explain it in the third lecture. And it uses L functions, equidistribution, and averaging over families of L functions in a very, very central way. Probably the most interesting, however, is the conjecture that I raised, as I say, in these Blythe lectures, I think, for the first time. And that was, that's Rudnick and I raised around then, and then in a paper that appeared in Communication Math Physics, and that is that these probability measures here, which are these eigenfunctions here, if you take their absolute square, and then that's a probability measure, do they converge to the volume form weakly? That is, if you integrate them against a function, will that converge to the average of the function? We call that the quantum unique ergodicity conjecture for reasons I'll explain in the third lecture. That is now a theorem in a remarkable paper that's just been written, and I have no doubt it's correct. A young ergodic theorist, Elon Lindenstrauss, has all but proven this. In the compact quotient, which I haven't introduced, I've only talked about SL2Z, but if a quotient were coming from a division algebra, he actually has proved it completely. Here he shows any weak limit. So the measures, you can take subsequences, and the conjecture here says that any weak limit is unique. There's only one weak limit. That's the same as saying the limit of a sequence of measures exists. He shows, he analyzes these weak limits, and he shows that any weak limit is a multiple of the volume form. He doesn't know that this multiple is 1, which is what the conjecture further asserts. So he's all but proven this conjecture, and in the compact case, he's proved it completely. And I want to explain in the third lecture a little bit of his ideas, because his ideas are not based on L functions. There's a little bit of L functions to get going, but then comes a theory which is beyond Ratner's work. So some of you may know that Ratner has a very beautiful theorem, solution of the Raghunathan conjecture, which, by the way, is proving to be extremely powerful in arithmetic, which classifies unipotent measures invariant under unipotent flows in these kind of situations. What he has is the first results which classify invariant measure under Cartan actions in G mod gamma, and I will explain a little bit why one might get to use ergodic theory on this problem, and it's a completely new kind of ergodic theory, which I think is going to lead to very many solution of many problems. And I should say that the theory L functions, certainly this conjecture would follow from the grand Riemann hypothesis, even from subconvexity for L functions, as I'll explain in the second lecture. But we've proved ourselves, or at least I've proved myself, to be too weak to actually prove that subconvexity. And here's a present, he avoids it and proves it anyway. All right, well, I hope I see some of you in some other lectures.